Today is Tuesday, September 19th. We're going to talk more about heart information, diastole and systole.
Okay, just doing a review on the EKG. Okay, so we're going to tie this back into the intrinsic conduction system. And the intrinsic conduction system is a built-in set of nervous tissue that controls the heart rate. We know the pacemaker of the heart is located in the right atrium, and its name is what?
SA node.
SA node, good. When that SA node fires, it sends a nerve impulse or a signal telling which chambers to contract.
Atria.
Atria, good. Now, we actually don't see contractions for the atria on this EKG. What we see instead is a depolarization wave that leads up to the contraction. Which wave corresponds here to atrial depolarization?
P wave.
P wave, good. Okay. So the actual contraction event for your atria occurs hidden behind what?
The QRS.
Yeah, QRS wave. And of course, that also hides atrial repolarization, meaning what?
It's going back.
Yeah, so resetting back to its resting state. So about the time that the atria are preparing to contract, the node that sits at the interventricular septum now receives an impulse. That node is called the AV node. It now fires off an impulse that is going to hit right here before the Q wave, and that impulse travels down the bundle of His. It splits into bundle branches and terminates with what? Purkinje fibers. Yep, hits those Purkinje fibers. Those Purkinje fibers release acetylcholine, and those ventricles now do what?
Depolarize.
Good. And of course, depolarization in the ventricles is a much bigger wave on the EKG. What wave now shows up?
QRS.
Yes, so that big QRS wave shows up when the ventricles depolarize. We actually don't see a wave for ventricular contraction. That's because it occurs after the S wave ends and before we begin what?
The T wave.
T wave, yeah. So that little flat space in there is the actual place for us to have a ventricular contraction. All right, so we assume contraction occurs and then we follow up with a T wave. What does that represent in the ventricles?
Repolarization,
right, returning to resting state, good. And then don't worry about you, we talked about that being a papillary muscle reset or repolarization. I just mention it because it's on this particular EKG. Okay, so this event of the cardiac cycle that we've just talked through takes on average about 0.8 seconds. That works out to an average resting heart rate of around 75 beats per minute. Okay, and if you want to measure the heart rate using EKG paper, then you don't measure from P wave to P wave. Instead, what do you use? R to R intervals, and that'll give you an estimate for how many seconds are in between, and you can use that to estimate the heart rate. Taylor, that's kind of what you wanted to hear. Okay. How about anything else that we've covered? Anybody need a refresher on anything else? Okay, so let's go back and talk about blood pressure and the cardiac cycle back on page 42. First thing I'd like to introduce are some terms, diastole or diastole, systole and systole. And of course, these terms mean something. Diastole or diastole means relaxation in the heart's chambers, while systole means contraction. We can be very specific and we can say atrial diastole or atrial systole. Likewise, we can also be very specific and talk about what the ventricles are doing. However, if we don't specify and we're just talking generally, we don't tell you which chambers we're discussing, the assumption goes to the ventricles. So if I simply talk about the heart is currently in diastole, your assumption is, oh, the ventricles are in diastole. Or if we say the heart is contracting, you would say, oh, the heart is in systole. Okay, so we kind of are lazy about it. We don't specify, even though we should, but if we don't specify, the assumption goes to what the ventricles are doing. I'm just checking to see if anybody needs a slide. No good. Okay. So to start with blood pressure readings there, you've got something like 120 over 80. This is the pressure created by the contraction and relaxation events in the heart. The systolic pressure is which of these two numbers?
120.
The top one, yeah, 120, good. And the bottom number there, 80, represents what pressure?
Diastolic,
good. And MMHG is what? Mercury, yeah, millimeters mercury. So it's how strong the contraction is as to how high a column of mercury is raised by that pressure. So those are the units that we use for blood pressure. The American Heart Association currently says that these are the upper end of what is considered normal heart blood pressure. The more ideal numbers, they say, are closer to 110 over 70. So they've actually lowered what they say is considered to be a normal or an ideal resting heart blood pressure. You'll notice on that chart at the top, I grabbed that off of the American Heart Association's website. When you're pushing above into the 130s and the 140s, we're getting into pre-hypertension and hypertension numbers. So what is hypertension? High blood pressure, right. And what are some dangers that can come with high blood pressure? Stroke, right. So we see that when blood pressure is high, the blood actually pushes harder against the walls of the vessels. That can cause clots to form, and if those clots are not removed, those can break free and cause embolisms. They can cause stroke and things of that sort. So we do see long-term cardiovascular damage if we see high blood pressure pushing in that 140 and above range. Why is the diastolic number not so as important as that systolic number? Yeah. That systolic, that high number, is when the heart is contracting. What is the heart doing during the diastolic number?
It's relaxing.
It's relaxing, right. So that relaxation is not going to be necessarily strong enough to cause the damage that a high systolic number could cause. You know, let's flip it the other way. You know, we talked about hypertension or high blood pressure. What if you have, say, blood pressure that's 80 over 40? Now what problem do we run into? Pass out, yeah, that's hypotension. And of course, there's an issue with not having blood pressure that's strong enough. What is not getting oxygen?
Your brain,
yeah. So there's issues that come from having too high or too low. That ideal number, the American Heart Association says, is closer to 110 over 70. So let me start you on your worksheet there with the cardiac cycle. You're noticing that we're starting in what's called mid to late ventricular diastole, and in parentheses, it's called ventricular filling. So let's just define what we're looking at. Mid to late ventricular diastole. Well, diastole means what?
Relaxation,
good. And because we're being very specific, we say it's ventricles that are doing the relaxing right now. So ventricular diastole means the ventricles are sitting here relaxed. So let's take a look at the picture on the left. In this picture, we see the ventricles relaxed. Blood is actually draining back into the atria and being pulled into the ventricles by gravity. Let's take the right atrium. The right atrium receives blood from three veins. What are they? Good. So SVC, IVC, coronary sinus all bring low-pressured, deoxygenated blood back into the right atrium. And simultaneously, the left atrium over here is receiving oxygenated blood from where?
Pulmonary
veins. Good. So blood is coming from these veins back into the atria. You'll notice these two AV valves are currently sitting open. Blood then drains through those open AV valves down into the ventricles. Gravity does a pretty good job of pulling a lot of that blood down into the ventricles. And then about that time, the SA node is going to fire off an impulse. That tells which chambers to contract.
The atria.
And so that'll finish the job of making sure that we push enough blood down into each ventricle. Okay? So let's take a look at ventricular diastole on your sheet. You'll notice that your semilunar valves are currently closed while your AV valves are currently open. Going back to when we discussed valves, their whole job is to prevent a backflow of blood. So right now, these semilunars happen to be closed. There is no need for them to open right now. And these tricuspid and bicuspid valves are simply open to let blood drain down into the two ventricles. So this is what we expect to see during the late part of resting state for your ventricles. You'll notice the next phase there is called atrial systole. That is specifically when your SA node fires an impulse and what chambers contract?
Atria.
Atria, good. About this time, you're going to have a pressure that's around 80, 70, okay? And so you'll notice that about the same time we're doing ventricular diastole, we're going to be also doing atrial systole. So when the atria contract, we only make a small pressure, about 70 or 80 millimeters mercury, to push that blood down into the two ventricles. Why don't we need a really high pressure?
Gravity.
Yeah, gravity's doing most of the work for you. So all we need to do is just finish the job, make a small contraction, and that helps finish pushing that blood down into those two ventricles. On your worksheet, you'll notice a bold-faced, all-caps term. At the end of ventricular diastole, we're going to measure the volume of blood in each ventricle. It is known as your end diastolic volume. This volume of blood in each ventricle is about how many milliliters? 120. Yes, yeah, about 120 milliliters. So that means your left ventricle and your right ventricle holds about the same amount of blood. Let's hit it from the top. We're going to start in what's called mid to late ventricular diastole, and during this time, blood flows back into the heart under low pressure. The right atrium receives blood from three veins. They are? IVC, SVC, coronary sinus. And is that blood oxygenated or deoxygenated?
Deoxygenated,
good. At the very same time, your left atrium receives blood from four
pulmonary veins.
Good. So blood is flowing at the same time into those two atria. Which valves are currently open during ventricular diastole? Yeah, those two valves, AV valves. So they're currently open, and gravity is pulling that blood down into your two ventricles. About this time, your SA node fires an impulse telling which chambers to contract.
The atria.
Good. When the atria contract, their contraction's not terribly strong. It's about 70 or 80 millimeters mercury pressure. They pump and they push blood through those open AV valves down into your ventricles. If we put pause on our story right now, each ventricle holds about how much blood? 120 milliliters, good. So just to give you an idea, you know, your typical Coke can is about 250 milliliters. So we're talking about half of that in each ventricle. So that's a pretty good volume of blood that we've got sitting in each ventricle at our end of diastole. So we're going to call that volume of blood in each ventricle our end diastolic volume, or you can simply say EDV. End diastolic volume, or you can call it EDV. Alright, so let's now take a look at our next phase. It's called ventricular systole, and in parentheses I noted this is also a time when the atria rest, so we're going to call that resting time atrial diastole. I'm going to take you over here to the other picture. Because the SA node fired, your atria contracted, and about the time we switch into ventricular systole, your AV node now receives that nerve impulse, and that nerve impulse is going to travel down your bundle of His. It splits into your bundle branches and travels the walls of your Purkinje fibers. So the Purkinje fibers release acetylcholine, and then your ventricle muscles begin to do what? Contract. Okay. So as they begin to contract, keep in mind that those capillary muscles anchor which valves?
The AV valves.
Good. So those capillary muscles contract as well. And so when they contract, they pull down on those chordae tendineae, making your AV valve slam shut. Okay? And I'm going to switch pictures for just a moment, because I haven't yet said that we're going to open up those semilunar valves. So if you were to pause right now, there's actually a very brief moment where all four valves are actually closed. In this picture here on the left, you'll notice that the ventricles are getting ready to contract. They've done their job in slamming shut those AV valves, but the pressure isn't quite great enough to push open those two semilunar valves. This is a time period where all four heart valves are closed. It's known as That's an isovolumetric contraction phase. Iso means what?
Same.
Good. So same volume. We're getting ready to contract. And just as an FYI, the heart valves are never all open at the same time, but they're in fact closed at the same time twice. Okay, so we've got an isovolumetric contraction phase, which we're talking about right now, and then in just a moment we'll talk about an isovolumetric relaxation phase. So let's start at the beginning of ventricular systole. At the beginning of ventricular systole, the AV node fires a nerve impulse. That nerve impulse travels down the bundle of His, bundle branches, Purkinje fibers, and it tells your ventricles to contract. When they begin to contract, they pull down on those chordae tendineae, and that will slam shut which valves?
The AV
valves. Pause right now. All four heart valves are currently closed. That's our isovolumetric contraction phase. The volume of blood in the ventricles is not currently changing. Well, the pressure becomes greater and greater because those ventricles are really contracting hard. And so now when we reach the peak of contraction, the pressure of blood is so fantastic that we have to force open another set of valves. Those are semilunar valves, good. So blood is ejected with great force from the heart. In fact, your left ventricle has a force of around 110 to 120 millimeters mercury of pressure. Speaking of your left ventricle, where do we send blood? To the body, good. Using what great big vessel?
Aorta,
good. And then, of course, we've got this pulmonary trunk here that's receiving blood from which ventricle?
The right ventricle.
Right ventricle, good. So with great force, we're going to push out this blood, eject it from the heart. The amount of blood we eject is going to be called the stroke volume. We're going to pump out about 70 milliliters with each contraction event. If you do the math, we started with 120. Mm-hmm. We pumped out 70. And that leaves us with how much sitting behind there in the heart?
50 milliliters.
50 milliliters, good. So now that we're at the end of systole, we're going to look at 50 milliliters of blood sitting in each ventricle. And I believe you're on the top of the next page, aren't you? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep, so there it is. End systolic volume is around 50 milliliters of blood. That's what's left behind in each ventricle after we contract and pump out blood. Okay, so end systolic volume is around 50 milliliters of blood. That is what is left behind after the heart contracts and pumps out a stroke volume of approximately 70 milliliters from each ventricle. Okay, so let's go back to the very beginning and start from the top. The story begins with blood draining into the right atrium from SVC, IVC, coronary sinus. It's low pressure, it's deoxygenated. At the very same time, the left atrium receives blood from four pulmonary what? Veins. Okay, and is that blood oxygenated or deoxygenated?
Oxygenated.
So we've got blood draining into the two atria. It's being pulled by gravity down through these open AV valves, and it's collecting down there in the two ventricles. About this time, the pacemaker fires a nerve impulse, and your atria contract. We push blood through those open AV valves down into the ventricles, and if we collected the volume of blood in each ventricle, it'd be about how many milliliters? 120. Yeah. And that's a volume of blood known as? Good. End diastolic volume. So we are now at the end of ventricular diastole. The ventricles are still resting, but their game is about to begin. So at this point, we're going to switch to the other picture. That AV node now fires an impulse that travels the bundle of His, bundle branches, and Purkinje fibers through the walls of those ventricles. Upon firing, they release acetylcholine, and your ventricles do what?
Contract.
They contract. Good. So when the ventricles contract, we're going to pump about how much blood out of each ventricle?
70 milliliters.
70 milliliters. Good. And that is known as our
stroke
volume. That's our stroke volume. Good. Do the math, we've got about 50 milliliters left in each ventricle. That's our end systolic volume because we are at the end of ventricular systole. And kind of going back and keeping track of those valves for just a moment, because we're getting ready to eject this blood, as we get ready to pump the blood out, because we haven't yet opened up the cellulars, we have an isovolumetric contraction phase. Once the blood is pumped through, those semilunars, of course, open. Blood is ejected from the heart. And then, when there's no more blood pushing against those two semilunar valves, they're going to then slam shut once again. And so, if we look at this picture here on the right, this is our isovolumetric relaxation phase. We have not yet allowed those AV valves to open up once again. So this is yet a second time when all four heart valves are sitting here closed. Okay, so let me take you back. There's something I did skip as we went through the story, and that has to do with valve sounds. Every time a valve slams shut, we hear a noise, and the noise is different for the semilunars than for the AV valves. So let's go back to the story and talk about the valves. When blood comes into the atria and travels down to the ventricles, AV valves are open, semilunar valves are what? They're closed. Good. When the ventricles contract, we slam shut our AV valves. That produces our first heart sound, a longer lub sound. So it's a longer noise than the quicker duck that we hear with the semilunar slamming shut. So the AV valve slamming shut causes turbulence of blood. Blood is being ejected from the heart, but it also kind of turbulates back up against those closed valves and makes a noise that we hear. So the lub noise comes from the closure and turbulence of blood from the AV valves. We eject that blood through those open semilunar valves. When there's no more blood traveling through, they then slam shut, and that causes a second heart sound. What does it sound like?
Duh.
Right. So it's a quicker noise. There's not as much blood turbulating against those closed valves, but nonetheless, the heart sounds that we associate with a heartbeat are actually not the contraction events. It's actually the valve closures that we associate those noises. kind of a cool concept. All right, so that should take you over to the middle of page 43. All right, so this is the story that you want to be able to go home and tell. So to be able to walk through ventricular diastole, ventricular systole, and it's a cycle, so it continues on and on. This is what you want to be able to feel comfortable talking about. Not necessarily something for flashcards, but a story that you want to be able to tell.
Would this happen to be an essay question?
I might pick parts of it. More likely, I would ask you, you know, when the ventricles contract, what valves are forced open, or I might ask you what a pressure is, because it's a pretty big story to tell otherwise. But I'm more likely pinpoint parts of it. Are there any parts of the story that I can repeat for you, or the whole thing? Why don't we let that stew in your brain, and then we can always come back to it another class period or multiple class periods if you need.
In both isovocal relaxation and isovocal contraction phases, all the valves are closed.
Correct. Yeah, all valves are closed. All right, just for review here, what do you think about this picture?
The atrium is contracting.
Yeah, atrium is contracting. Good. How do you know? Good. Flow of the blood going into the ventricles. That is the best clue there. Good. This one is atrial systole. Good. And how about this one? Ventricular systole, good. So how did you know?
Because of the flow of the blood going out of the area in the atrium.
Similar valve.
That's it, good. So you're going out to the aorta and pulmonary trunk. If you take a look at the old test, I've had stuff like this on the old test. Yeah, so you may want to make sure that you think about, you know, where the blood is flowing as to what phase you're in of the heart relaxation or contraction. I did want to show you this. This is not necessarily something to sit and stare at here in the classroom, but rather if you go home and take a look at it, it's a pretty cool website, and it takes staring at it to really fully appreciate what they've got here. This is at the University of Utah. It's got diastole and systole. Along the bottom here, they've got all your phases that we've talked about. They have a corresponding EKG. They have heart sounds. And then this is a little more complicated. This is the volume and the pressure in the heart. So it really takes sitting and staring at it to fully appreciate what all it's encompassing on this one page. But a pretty cool website in terms of actually showing you how blood flows.
What we need to know about the ejection fraction?
We are going to talk about ejection fraction, yeah. Let's go back to probably ventricular systole. Let's take a look at that. So if you have paid attention to heart monitors, you know, if somebody has hooked up to an EKG, for instance, oftentimes there's a bunch of information on there, and there may be a piece of info that says E with a little F on it. And that is the ejection fraction. It's actually a measure of how effective the heart is at pumping out blood. And so it's based on body size because, you know, we know that men have more blood than women do. But nonetheless, it's a ratio. So let's think about this. What is our typical volume for EDV?
120.
And how much of that blood do we pump out for a stroke volume?
70.
So without pulling out a calculator, 60 out of 120 is exactly half, right? So 70 out of 120 sounds like a little more than half. Yeah, so maybe about like 60% or so. So that's actually what the ejection fraction should be. It ranges from about 50% to the mid 60% for people. And even though that sounds like a horribly low number, that's what it's supposed to be. So we do leave behind about 50 milliliters of blood in each ventricle. That's not ejected with the stroke volume of blood that we're sending out. So about 50 to 60% means that we're doing our job and the heart is pumping blood adequately. Okay, so I know that doesn't sound like a very good percentage, but it's good. Okay. About midway of your page, let's talk about right side and left side pressure differences. Give you some blanks there to fill in. Right side pressure is actually very low. Normally, it's around 24 over 8 millimeters mercury. Right side pressure is normally 24 over 8. So you think about, gosh, that's insanely low. Well, the only job of the right side is to send blood where?
To the lungs.
To the lungs, yeah. So we don't need an incredible amount of pressure. We can detect that pressure with a sensor placed into the heart or the chambers there to be able to sense what is being sent over to the lungs. The left side pressure is the one that we more commonly are familiar with. That one is typically about 120 over 80 millimeters mercury. Or if you go by the American Heart Association, they say 110 over 70 is the more ideal number. But that's what we normally think of when we think about systolic over diastolic pressure. Underneath that left side, it says systemic circuit. What does that mean we're doing with the blood?
Sending it to the body,
right? So it goes out the aorta, travels to the body. Well, since the job of these valves is to keep blood from backflowing to a former location, let's talk about some problems with these valves. Do you expect to see the problems more on the right side of the heart or more on the left side of the heart?
Left side,
yeah, because we're sending blood with higher pressure on the left side. One issue here is called an incompetent valve. It is one that does not shut properly, and you can see the aorta is affected by this incompetent valve. In this case, what do you expect blood to do that has already passed through the aortic semilunar valve? Backflow, yeah. And backflow to where?
Left ventricle.
Yep.
Oh.
Yeah, it goes back into the left ventricle.
My mom has mitral valve.
Yeah, we're going to look at that one too.
Okay.
It's oftentimes called a heart murmur, and it's just a faulty left AV valve. We'll look at that. I got a video for that one too. Okay, so thinking about this incompetent valve issue, if some of your blood is backflowing down into your left ventricle where it just came from, what impact do you think this has on stroke volume? Yeah, do you think your stroke volume is still 70 milliliters? It'll be lower. Yeah. Yes, so less blood gets pumped out, right? More blood is pooling back in your left ventricle. And if your normal ejection fraction, say, let's pick 55%, what impact will this have on your ejection fraction?
It'll lower it,
yeah. And ultimately, if you're talking about your aorta, you're talking about problems perfusing all that blood out the cells and tissues.
Now, when you say the stroke volume, what would it be higher or lower? The stroke volume would be lower, but the ventricle pressure would be higher, right?
Well, you just get more blood to drain back into the ventricle. And because we've already contracted, then the pressure is probably not really affected. It's just going to have to try to get that blood out with the next event.
Okay.
Is this what causes uneven pumping? People have one side of the heart there.
Yeah. That could do it, yeah, because then you're having to accommodate for trying to get blood to be ejected. Another issue that has to do with getting adequate blood out into circulation is called a stenotic valve. This is an aortic valve stenosis, and you'll notice the opening here looks like it's pretty tight. And so that means, again, that we have difficulty ejecting out a stroke volume of 70 milliliters. And again, we may reduce the ejection fraction. So unfortunately, that aortic valve is an important one, and it's often the one affected by these valve issues. And like we were talking here, MVP is not your most valuable player. This is certainly not what you want to have. The left side, of course, deals with a lot of pressure. So if you happen to have pressure that puts some strain on that left AV valve or mitral or bicuspid valve, it can prolapse, which means it droops down into the left ventricle. That means it's not sitting up really sturdy between the left atrium and left ventricle like it's supposed to be. So once again, every time your ventricle contracts, it spews blood back into the left atrium rather than letting the blood go out through the aorta. So it seems that most of these valve issues do fall on the left side. It all has to do with this high pressure issue that we're dealing with. I had a couple of videos for you to look at. This one is demonstrating a normal valve first. And then now, of course, they're showing us an incompetent valve, and you can actually see blood going back up from the left ventricle into the left atrium.
My mom didn't find hers until after she had kids. Is that, would that be a cause for it? Or did she have it her whole life and it just didn't cause problems?
It could be both. It could be the strain of having the we carry extra blood when we're pregnant. It could be that put extra strain on the heart, or it could have been there in a smaller, undetectable level before, and it just became more noticeable after, having kids.
Then you said that can cause a shortness of breath.
Yeah, lightheadedness, not getting enough blood out into circulation makes you feel tired. So yeah, shortness of breath if you've got a fairly, I guess, a severe case of that.
And it bothers them more as you stress, too.
I can imagine, yeah. That just is another, that looks like the same one once again. This is kind of cool. This is an ultrasound, a sonogram here. Kind of cool, you can see the mitral valve. There's your tricuspid valve over there. This really shows you how big that left ventricle is.
That's really cool.
Yeah. Looks like something funky is sticking up, doesn't it? Yeah.
It looks like a bad dance move.
Yeah. Some uncoordinated dance move, right? And I like that they color-coded it, because it looks like flames shooting up in their left atrium, but that's blood. Yep, you're right.
So is it just them, slipping past each other and not closing anymore?
That's what it looks like. It said a P2 scallop, so it must be a piece of that leaflet not closing up like it's supposed to. So, being cusped, I assume they're supposed to seal up, and apparently it's not sealing up like it's supposed to. Yeah. Bottom page has a question down there for you, very bottom of the page. Why do you think that valve issues are more often on the left side than for the right side?
Higher pressure.
Yep.
And I asked Dr. J about the tricuspid and bicuspid valve. Why is there a bicuspid valve on the side that has more pressure versus the tricuspid on the side that has lower pressure? And he was saying that it's probably because two valves coming together is stronger than three valves coming together.
That makes sense, yeah.
There's more of a seal.
More of a seal, yeah. Okay. Topic page 44 has some information kind of related to what we were just discussing. It has to do with cardiac output. We actually have already talked about this back when we discussed blood. On average, cardiac output is about 5 liters of blood that we're circulating. So this calculation makes it a little more, about 5.25 liters of blood that we circulate every minute. You'll notice that cardiac output depends upon two variables. You'll want to highlight and know this. The two variables are stroke volume and heart rate. Watch the units. The stroke volume is normally measured in milliliters of blood. Stroke volume on average is about 70 milliliters. And the heart rate we know is at rest around 75 beats per minute. If we do the math and multiply those two factors together, we get around 5,000 milliliters of blood being circulated per minute. But if we convert milliliters to liters, that's how we're going to get 5.25 on average liters of blood being pumped by your heart every minute.
That's a lot.
And during exercise, if you're at the max heart rate, you can be circulating 12 to 15 liters per minute. It's a lot of blood. All right, so these values or factors are all proportioned to each other, meaning that if you increase heart rate, you're going to increase stroke volume and cardiac output. If you decrease one of these factors, then they all decrease across the board. So we say that they're directly proportioned to each other. When one factor or variable increases, they all are going to increase. Likewise, if one factor or variable decreases, then they all decrease together. So just something to keep in mind, the relationship between these factors. We've already talked about EDV and ESV. Do y'all have any questions on those two? Okay. Bottom of the page talks about stroke volume and what can influence stroke volume. So let's talk about these three terms, preload, contractility, and afterload. Basically, preload is what comes into the heart. When we talk through the story of the cardiac cycle and we say that blood comes into the atria and gravity pulls it down to the ventricles, we ended up with an end diastolic volume of around 120 milliliters sitting in each ventricle. Was that our EDV or ESV number? EDV, yeah. So when blood drains into each ventricle has around 120 milliliters of blood. That's our EDV, okay? And I kind of think about your heart right now like a water balloon. If you start filling up a ventricle with blood, then like a water balloon, the walls are going to stretch. And so we think of the preload as the stretch experienced by those ventricles. So if I had to remember one word for preload, I would remember it's the stretch. You'll notice that preload is increased by things like exercise. You know, exercise brings around 12 to 15 liters of blood in circulation per minute. That's a lot of blood coming back to the heart, and there's a great deal of stretch experienced by those ventricles. You'll notice that preload is decreased by nitroglycerin. I'm sure you've heard of nitrotabs or nitrogel before. Nitroglycerin helps to reduce the amount of oxygen demanded by the heart. So the heart doesn't work as hard when nitroglycerin is present. So that decreases the stretch experienced by those ventricles. So I'm sure you've had somebody at some point pop a rubber band at you, right? Okay, so if they just barely pull on the rubber band, you know it's not going to hurt very hard when they let go. But if they stretch the heck out of it and then they let go, you know, oh, that's going to sting, right? So when we talk about preload and we say preload is the stretch, we know that when we let go, there is a greater contraction when you let go and let those muscles shorten. So our next term here is called contractility. And that has to do with the strength of the contraction. Okay, so the greater you stretch, the greater the contraction, the greater the strength of that contraction. If you've got strong, healthy muscle tissue, then it's going to contract upon release, right? Okay? But if you've got flabby, worn-out muscle tissue, like bad underwear that needs to go in the garbage can, when you let go, it's just going to sit there, right? Okay? So contractility, or the strength of the muscle tissue, is going to relate to the contraction. How effective are we at pumping out the blood? In people who have had a heart attack and they damage part of their muscle tissue, the contraction is not as strong. So to get the blood effectively pumped out and to maintain an ejection fraction, the heart has to pump harder and harder. What do you think happens to the size of the heart when it has to overwork itself? It gets larger, yes. Yeah. So we call it hypertrophy. Now, an athlete may experience muscular hypertrophy of the heart, but that's different from the flabby hypertrophy that we see that comes with heart disease. So an ineffective heart is one that is enlarged in order to pump out the blood.
So they, okay, so when you exercise, it's building the muscle in your heart, basically?
Yeah.
Okay.
And like if you talk about an Olympic-type athlete that's very well exercised,
right,
then a hypertrophied heart for that person is normal.
Right.
But you take a 70-year-old who's had several heart attacks, that hypertrophied heart is not the muscular heart muscle.
Right, right.
Yeah. Some things that can influence contractility are probably not a surprise. You know, thinking back to Bio-210, we know that calcium is necessary to reveal binding sites on those thin filaments. And so the more calcium you have, the more binding sites you can reveal, and therefore the stronger the contractions can be. So calcium increases contractility, or the strength of contractions in the heart. We know that sympathetic stimulation, such as epinephrine and norepinephrine, can also increase the strength of contraction. All it takes is for somebody to say, test, and your heart starts beating harder, right? So, yeah. That or scaring you, right? Gives that heartbeat a kick. Glucagon raises blood sugar. What does thyroxine raise?
Metabolism.
Yep. And then also digitalis is a drug that increases the strength of contraction in those who have, say, chronic heart failure. So these are all things that can help make sure that the heart contracts stronger and is more effective at pumping out that blood. Besides, what stroke volume is it we're trying to maintain?
70.
70, right. 70 milliliters we're trying to maintain. Contractility can be decreased by medications and excess potassium. Potassium actually makes your heart go more into a resting state. So thinking back, which hormone helps to regulate potassium levels? Think adrenal glands.
Oh.
Aldosterone, yeah. Yeah. Yes. It's gone, yeah. So if you've got aldosterone issues, then you can have hyperkalemia, which can make your heart go into arrhythmias or potentially arrest. All right, and then afterload is the pressure that we must overcome to get the blood back out of the heart. So think of it this way. What comes in through preload must go out through afterload. Mm-hmm. If you had to remember one word to describe afterload, it's the pressure that we must overcome to help pump the blood out of the heart. So let's think about this. As people age, they may collect plaques in their vessels. Those plaques make the vessels more narrow, and of course, you can't get as much blood through when you've got the vessel clogged up. The heart, you know, is knowing that you're not getting enough blood. There's a feedback mechanism here. So of course, if you're trying to pump blood out to your important vital organs like your brain, what are you going to have to do to get blood through a now more narrowed vessel?
Push harder.
Push harder, yeah. So the pressure will increase. That's how blood pressure is increased in response to clogged up vessels. And so it's a feedback mechanism that unfortunately just gets worse. This is actually a positive feedback mechanism. So the higher the pressure, the harder the heart works, and more likely the more plaques we're trying to push blood through. So it unfortunately results in heart failure.
You know what? Since 210, I had that question because you said that in the beginning of 210 that heart pressure, mm-hmm, blood pressure was a positive feedback.
So now it makes sense, yeah. Yeah. All right, so that takes you down to the bottom of the page. Do y'all have any questions on those three terms? Let's just see what we can do a little bit with the next page. These are some factors that influence cardiac output. All right, so a lot of this stuff is just a recap. We've talked about this in various places in Bio-210 and in 211. We're just kind of putting it all together here for one. We know that sympathetic nervous system activity will increase your heart rate. If you increase heart rate, what does that do to cardiac output? Increases it too, yeah. So they're, of course, linked together. They're directly proportioned to each other. So epinephrine and norepinephrine do make the heart beat faster and, of course, with greater contractility. Let's talk hormones. We, of course, just talked about epinephrine and norepinephrine. We know that thyroxine is another one that helps to increase heart rate. I did want to mention on your worksheet something called a beta blocker that can block epinephrine or norepinephrine. So why might someone take a beta blocker?
Slow the heart rate,
right. I've got a condition called SVT. It's supraventricular tachycardia, and it means that I have a resting heart rate around 95 to 100 beats per minute. You know, that's kind of high. That's to that top end of the normal range, right? So beta blockers block the effects of epinephrine, and of course that lowers the heart rate. So when I'm on the medication, which is every day, then my heart rate's around 75 beats per minute. You know, the really cool thing about it, somebody can walk in and scare me, and you know, you're waiting for that adrenaline rush, and you're waiting for your heart to beat out of your chest. It never happens. Yeah. So it's kind of freaky. It's a little unnerving when you're waiting for that rush of adrenaline that never actually hits your heart.
So when someone scares you, you just happen to jump and just look at them?
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, oh yeah, okay, whatever, you know. It's okay. I mean, it's not necessary for...
So roller coasters are the game thing.
Now that's a different story. That makes my stomach come up, you know. But yeah.
So
but
you still have like fight or flight reflexes.
Yeah, and I still feel it in my skeletal muscles. It's almost like your skeletal muscles light on fire. You know, when somebody scares you, you kind of feel yourself like bristle up. But you're waiting. Yeah, you're ready to run, and you're waiting for your heart to go boom, and it just never does.
So it's just
my heart doesn't do it.
So technically, with your heart, you're always in 100. Like we say 0 to 100, we're talking about fight or flight response. So you're always at 100.
Yeah. And thank goodness for the beta blocker, because it keeps me more at a normal rate.
Okay.
When I did a stress test, they say most people take 15 minutes to reach max heart rate. I took 15 seconds.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I had a cure for that.
Heart rate?
Yeah. It'll work. You won't need a
medicine. That's good, because medicine makes your blood pressure low too.
Yeah.
And it makes you like this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Good. Want to go to sleep?
Oh, I would love that. Sleep is great. Let's see. Hyperkalemia is another condition that can cause high blood pressure. Let's think big picture here. What hormone raises blood calcium? Calcitonin or its buddy?
Parathyroid.
Yeah. Parathyroid can do it. So there are medications that block calcium entry into the heart muscle tissue. They're called, guess what, calcium channel blockers. But they also can look at your parathyroid levels to see if there's a condition that's underlying that high blood calcium. Low potassium is a real concern. Diabetics who take insulin may in fact have low potassium levels, and that can cause the heart to beat feebly or even with arrhythmias. So unfortunately, potassium levels are a real big influence on the heart, and we have to look at aldosterone for that, or we can possibly look at insulin for that. I think I'll save the bottom part of the page. We didn't get, of course, halfway through on that page. We'll wrap this up on Thursday, and let's start blood vessels on Thursday. So if you'd like to look ahead, that's where we're going.